The debate about the use of private transport and public transport is conducted in the language of absolutes. I find phrases like that used in the recent Cabinet Office paper unhelpful in this debate. Phrase I quote near the beginning of the paper: at present, in town and country alike, around a third of adults do not have access to a car. For them, a transport policy which relied on the car would be disastrous. But so would attempts to force people to give up the car on which they have come to rely. Of course, no sensible person wishes to ban the car or to oblige people to use public transport. But those of us who seek to reduce the unpleasant side effects of unrestricted use of cars with a package of mitigating measures, including reductions in accidents and injuries, control of atmospheric and noise pollution and congestion, are sometimes accused of impinging on what others describe as their freedom or liberty. In a recent survey which I have conducted in a small South Oxfordshire village, which has benefited from a much enhanced bus service following the introduction of the rural bus service grant, 96 out of the 170 people returning the questionnaire said they now use the bus. Now, in fact, 2 or 3 years ago, they couldn't have used the bus because there wasn't a proper bus service. But interestingly, two-thirds of these people had a car available to them. And this suggests to me that people do not see the issue of the use of public or private transport as an absolute choice. You have one or the other. And that many people would willingly make use of public transport when it is available and convenient. A key element in this debate is to make public transport attractive, or at the very least, much less repulsive by attending to its negative characteristics. Public transport is a product which is often sampled and often found wanting. People and their families, often with access to a car, occasionally use public transport. More probably the train than the bus. And of course, many of these people are dissatisfied with what they find. It's perhaps a good thing that they are, because if they all came and used public transport, sampled it and found it to their liking and stayed, then public transport would have a huge job in accommodating their demands. And tackling the causes of this dissatisfaction is a challenge to engineers, scientists, technologists, economists, and politicians. But to re-emphasize the point, no sensible analysis suggests that using a car is intrinsically wrong or sinful. Neither does such analysis suggest that there is an alternative to the car for every journey or in every place. So policy should aim to widen the choice available to more people. And because funds are limited, investment in alternatives is best focused on those journeys where public transport, or indeed cycling or walking, are reasonable substitutes for car travel. Statistics are quoted showing the proportion of rural parishes that do not have a daily bus service. A better, though not perfect, measure is the proportion of dwellers in rural parishes, say with a population of 3,000 or less, who live within a particular, say, 13 minutes walk of a bus stop, with a bus service of at least once an hour. Now, 42% of such settlements enjoy that level of service at present, and it may well be better to concentrate resources in widening the scope of an already existing, modestly adequate bus service so that it runs a bit earlier, it runs a bit later, it runs every day of the week, or to run more frequently, than to attempt to diffuse that network to include ever more remote parishes where car use or community transport is a more appropriate response. Land use planning is important in reducing car dependence. Reviving urban centres and concentrating development along corridors served by public transport are important measures, but the bullying power of large companies threatening to take investment and jobs elsewhere often overcomes sensible planning policies. And a particular example is Vodafone at Newbury, who have a large number of separate places in the centre of Newbury and threatened to leave with all the jobs unless they were granted planning consent on a greenfield site outside the town, and in the end that they won. And of course, rivalry between local authorities seeking to attract inward investment again goes against the policy I have been describing. And of course, when development is intensified, the issue of where to park the cars, which inevitably seem to follow, is a major challenge. And turning to a point made by Rod Smith about parking at Sheffield Station, it is notable that one of the reasons, only one of the reasons why Govia won, or has become the preferred bidder for the franchise for the South Central franchise, is that they offered to add 7,000 car parking spaces to those available, as against the 2,000 that was offered by the rival bidder. So the Strategic Rail Authority, of which I'm a member, is very conscious of the point made. Now, there are a number of obstacles to the operation of decent bus services. The first, of course, is urban traffic congestion, which we saw on the slide. This makes it nearly impossible to operate a reliable service. The licensing authority, that is the traffic commissioners, have recently defined what they regard as acceptable limits for reliability, outside which they are prepared to take action to withdraw an operator's licence. And this has been defined as 95% of buses arriving at bus stops along the route not more than 1 minute early or 5 minutes late. At the same time, research by Colin Buchanan and partners in several cities has shown that these levels of reliability cannot be achieved in many, and I suspect myself, most British cities. The answer to this problem lies in much more vigorous highway management policies, or of course in the segregation of public transport onto light, rapid transit or guided busways. And because the police have virtually withdrawn from urban highway management, this is increasingly the province of local authorities, and they will require as much technology as possible to back up the enforcement effort. Congestion charging or workplace parking levies are seen as possible measures to reduce urban congestion, but these schemes are likely to be slow to be introduced and may not address the issue of keeping the main bus routes clear. Another problem which buses suffer from is the time taken for passengers to get on and off, the dwell time at bus stops. This would be reduced if the transaction time paying the driver could be reduced by the use of technology without an increase in fraud. Buses themselves are often uncomfortable, with narrow seats, poor suspension, a jerky ride, and do not give passengers an adequate feeling of personal safety. As with many new trains, the desire, often vociferously demanded by regulators, to squeeze in too many seats leads to discomfort for all at both peak and off-peak times. These design faults make a poor comparison with car travel. Of course, the privacy of car travel is obviously impossible to emulate in public transport, but packing people together does not help. All public transport requires far more and often repeated to attention, both before and during the journey. Technically, this is within our grasp, but delivery of systems lags well behind technical capability. And of course, bus travellers are not numbered in the vanguard of the information technology literate. Modern communication systems are also prone to break down when services are disrupted, and we have seen quite a lot of that in the last 2 or 3 weeks. This is presumably because of the rather narrow performance specifications which are set for these systems. And as I say, recent troubles on the railway have exposed the weakness of communication systems. Yet, of course, these failures undermine confidence in technology and lead for the calls we often hear to have more staff available. Technology has the potential to do so much in terms of highway management, enforcement, information distribution and payment systems, and yet realisation of the benefits seems slow and expensive. Ministers and politicians have been very reluctant to authorise measures like enforcement of bus lanes using camera technology, and a whole long, drawn-out circus of trials, evaluation, type approval seems to stultify progress. Even greater reluctance seems to surround proposals to introduce payment systems for road use. There is no doubt such systems work. I've been to Oslo, I've seen films of lots of other places where they work, but to persuade a sceptical and hostile media, politicians and the motoring fraternity that things will work for the best is very difficult. When discussing issues such as the introduction of congestion charging in London, one is challenged with the argument that a scheme could not be introduced unless better public transport is in place beforehand. Yet the better bus services cannot operate until the congestion has been reduced in the first place. There is a need for an act of faith to bridge the transitional period, but the patience needed is unlikely to be forthcoming. The headlines, chaos and crisis, are too appealing, and there is a lack of realisation that there is a learning process to be gone through while users get used to the new arrangements. This learning process has been experienced in Oxford, and I'm an Oxfordshire County Councillor, with the introduction of the Central Area Traffic Management Scheme, the Oxford Transport Strategy. And this has now been going for a year, and we're beginning to see the results, and traffic flows around the inner core in Oxford are down by 20% over the last 12 months. We've managed to reduce pollution, the footfall of pedestrians in the city centre has gone up, the use of bus services has gone up by 9%, and the use of the park and ride has gone up. But it has taken a year to battle to that position against huge hostile media attention. There is a great need for technology to work first time. If it does, then resistance can be overcome. The ticket barriers on London Underground are an example of good performance overcoming the self-interested opposition of the trade unions, whose members used to collect your money, and the resistance of, I say again, self-interested safety bodies like the London Fire Brigade, who lobbied against this because it would trap passengers in the underground and they would all get burned. It is therefore all the more important that new railway rolling stock works when it is introduced, and unfortunately this is seldom the case. I don't know why, but I suspect it's because there are inadequate timescales allowing for testing. But part of the reason must lie in the disintegrated nature of our railway, a fact alluded to by Gerald Corbett of Railtrack in his speech to the CBI last week. When speaking about bus travel, I said that quality must rise if the bus is to become an acceptable alternative to more people than the private car. Similarly, if rail travel is to have a wider appeal, then the quality of the product must improve out of all recognition. This appears to be what the country wants. The cost will be substantial, and I doubt whether the present structure of the railway can deliver this quality. Railway travel in Britain has always been delivered within very tight budgetary constraints. Track and signalling capacity has been provided on a just enough rather than a just in time basis, just enough basis. Renewal has been postponed until after the previous equipment has passed through the obsolescent and the obsolete phases. If traffic levels, I'm talking about what used to happen on British Rail, rose above capacity, prices were raised to choke off demand without regard to the costs imposed elsewhere, which fell, of course, onto somebody else's shoulders. All railway staff were brought up in a make-do and mend culture, but at least they all worked in one team and struggled together. Privatisation brought two changes. First of all, a severing of the team spirit, as the players were divided up among 100 companies, linked together not in a common cause, but working for employers intent on securing their own narrow advantage as defined in contract. And second, the second change has been the unanticipated rise in the number of passengers and the amount of freight. And quite clearly, the system has broken down under the strain. Unrealistic performance regimes, perverse incentives, and threats of criminal prosecution will all have had their effects on management. As I understand engineering, much of the skill is the management of assets in decline, which involves making judgments about intervention, and of course, threatening people with prosecution will engender defensive and probably suboptimal responses. There are therefore two big issues to face: putting together a robust and reliable railway with the quality features expected by the public and freight users whom we want to use the railway will cost money and it will take time. It will cost less, in my opinion, if we organise the railway so that technology and machinery can be deployed to best advantage in carrying out the physical work. And this, in my view, means providing adequate intervals for maintenance and renewal of the infrastructure and the provision of robust alternative routes to which trains and travellers can be diverted when maintenance work is necessary or when the inevitable incident occurs. I call this making the system robust, which it certainly is not now. Secondly, and short of going through another protracted and painful reorganisation, we must decide whether the present structure of the railway, particularly, in my view, the existence of two regulators, is fit for purpose. We must consider carefully all the incentive structures put in place and look to ensure that these work together to effect delivery of high quality. There is good practice available in many parts of the world, both in managing scarce road space, which may be described in the context of tonight's discussion as the sticks, because it depends on restrictions, charging, enforcement, and on the other hand, in providing good, well-integrated public transport, which of course constitutes the carrots. The first requires political will to achieve, and in my view, this is lacking. The second requires absolute clarity of regulatory purpose. What is it we are trying to do? It also requires rather more money than we as a nation have so far been willing to commit. Thank you.